No, it's just on the new guys.
All right, I think we're live here. It's the last day of Tech Ed, very early in the morning, so thank you for those of you who made it here. A couple things we'll just talk about. We'll do introductions here, and then we'll kind of frame out the way that the session is going to run. And actually, why don't we go ahead and frame it, and then we'll pass along, we'll introduce ourselves, and we can kind of kick off here. So the way that the session will run is we've prepared just a little bit of information on each of the areas that we focus on. So each of us will spend about 5 minutes on some of the new things in Windows 8.1 that's coming this way. And then the rest of the time is on more interactive question and answer. So if you have questions on 8, if you have questions on Windows, on 8.1, we're here to try to answer those. So why don't we go ahead, we can kick off and introduce ourselves. We'll start down on your end, Chris. Okay.
Hi, I'm Chris Hallam. I'm the Senior Product Manager for Windows Client Security. And effectively what that means is if there's any security technologies in the box for client or even shared in server, those fall under my domain. So that would be BitLocker, AppLocker, Trusted Boot, anything to keep the device secure. That's the area that I manage.
I'm Mike Niehaus. I do Windows deployment, Windows manageability, Windows RT. So just a few somewhat loosely related areas. So anything related to any of those we can talk about in more detail. Like hopefully most of you are looking at Windows 8.1 and considering at least trying that out in a lab. We can talk about any of the technologies around that.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Dockery. I am Senior Product Manager as well. So I manage the MDOP business. Who's heard of MDOP? Good. So I manage MDOP and I also manage desktop virtualization. So hoping that you've seen the beta announcement yesterday at the keynote, UEV, APV, that's my stuff. So actually, before I go to Craig, we have a survey. If anybody wants to fill out a survey on MDOP, would you put your hand up and we'll give you a survey? Really appreciate it if you could. Laurie, I'll just take your hand you a survey. Anybody will? Perfect, one, two, great. So that's me.
Great, and I'm Craig Ashley. I'm a senior product manager on the Windows commercial team as well. I focus on Windows to go and on networking, direct access, VPN, some of the other new networking features or connectivity features that we talked about in the keynote yesterday. So brief introductions there. Now, why don't we, I guess we can go ahead and start back on the end with Chris on security again, and you want to talk a little bit about some of the great new things from a security perspective that are headed our way?
Sure. So how many of you attended any of the security sessions that I did? Got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, something like that. Okay, good. So you're going to hear, the people who attended are going to hear a little bit of the same thing, but sounds like we have a new audience here. So so when we look at, if we roll back the clock to Windows 8 and we look at what our goals for that release were, our goal was basically to deliver groundbreaking malware resistance. And you know, I know that sounds like marketing fluff, but our goal was really to make dramatic change on our malware resistance capabilities. And we were able to achieve that with a number of features. There's probably about 10, but I'll tell you a couple about three of them. The first one is called Secure Boot, which is a new capability in the firmware of the PC. So there's a technology called UEFI. This is a replacement for BIOS, and this gives us the ability to securely start up an operating system. The BIOS that you have in Windows 7 PCs and earlier just starts whatever it's told, and it quite possibly could be malware. But on these new devices, it's not going to be malware. Really not possible unless you can compromise the integrity of UEFI. So we have a secure boot now. And so boot kits are really effectively no longer a problem. But there's still a couple of attack vectors that are possible, but we're doing lots of work to make sure nobody succeeds in those attacks. So secure boot is very interesting. And then we follow up with secure boot with a feature called trusted boot. And that protects the remainder of the Windows boot process. And there's also a slot within that process for the anti-malware solution. So for the first time in Windows and maybe in any operating system, I'm not sure if anybody else did this, we have the anti-malware solution effectively embedded in the boot process and it's protected. So the attack where you install like a kernel mode driver and have it tamper with the anti-malware solution, there's still some challenges there, but effectively we've blocked that attack vector almost entirely. And so now you have a complete boot process that's protected, and your anti-malware solution is going to be running before any third-party content, which means malware will always start after your defenses. So this is pretty cool. There's a lot of other features as well. But malware resistance was the big investment area in 8. There were a lot of other things, but that was the big hero. When we roll the clock forward to 8.1, we're seeing a shift away from malware, not completely, but we're seeing identity theft is really the new area of the black hat. So rather than trying to provision malware to your PC and maybe steal your identity that way, they're using other means to get your identity. We've all seen some of the things on the internet where databases on the internet have been compromised and your usernames and passwords have been compromised and these types of things. Well, a lot of people use the same password across every site that they use. And so usually when somebody hacks one site, they can get your account elsewhere. And so we're working very hard on that area now. There's a couple of features that are important there. The first one you saw in the keynote, and that is biometrics. So our goal is in a series of steps, two of which have been taken already in 8 and 8.1, is our goal is to get you off of passwords. And as you know, we've been using passwords for about 40 years or longer now. They're not going to go away overnight. I can't turn the switch off and say passwords are gone. Even if I had the technology in place, it's just going to require some time and some adoption. So the first two pieces are virtual smart cards, which is a electronically provisionable two-factor authentication option. That was available in 8, and we've improved it in 8.1. That solution is now deployable to non-domain joined PCs. So if you have consumer devices or even BYOD, they can now have a two-factor authentication option that completely moves them away from passwords. And then biometrics allows them to use their biometric identity. One thing that's important is while we're using your biometric identity for authentication, technically there still is a password in place behind it. So the password kind of gets buried under the hood, and you use your biometric identity to decrypt it, and then it gets used in the background. So there's another step that we're going to take after 8.1 to completely eliminate passwords. So biometrics is a big deal. The other thing there is with PKI, public key infrastructure on the internet, and also within your corporation, that system is entirely based on the assumption that the identities that are using that system will not be compromised and that they're always secure. There are many, many cases where we've seen that is not the case, and so we should no longer assume that our digital identities and PKI are secure, because we've seen them hacked again and again, not at scale. So we're not seeing like a Code Red. If you remember XP, where we had Code Red and Slammer, we're not seeing that volume of attacks on it, but we think that's the next area that attackers will go to. We've delivered two features there that are interesting. The first feature is a cloud-based service that's going to be designed to clean up the public key infrastructure on the internet. So if there's ever a case where a digital identity for a website such as Microsoft or Yahoo or Google is compromised, and we start seeing that show up on servers, maybe in Dagestan or some strange place where we know that there are not data centers, we'll be able to detect that with this cloud service, and we'll be able to initiate a remediation process with the stakeholder, which could be Microsoft or Google or Apple, and the certificate authority. So we can effectively revoke those certificates and basically deny access to those malicious servers. So that's one scenario. And then the second scenario is about your certificates that are on your PC. There are a number of tools that can be used to export those digital identities, even though they're technically non-exportable. There are tools that you can use if you have physical access and admin access to the PC. You can steal these identities, even though it's not supposed to happen. We've now used hardware binding using the TPM, the Trusted Platform Module, to prevent the theft of those digital identities. And not only that, we've added a capability that will enable the services on your network to verify that the certificates are being used for authentication have never been compromised. And that's a feature called TPM key attestation. It has the ability to help determine whether the certificates and identities provisioned to a device have been provisioned to the right device and that they've been secured, but to the device using TPM. And if the answer to that question is no, then services could deny access to those PCs because maybe they're not trustworthy. So there's a little more than 5 minutes, but those are some of the key things we're doing in 8.1 for security.
Excellent. Michael?
Okay, so from a Windows deployment perspective, this was a busy week. We released the preview, which I'm sure you've all seen. Hopefully you've all picked up your USB key from the desk up front and are getting ready to try that out. But we've also released updated assessment and deployment toolkit, updated Microsoft deployment toolkit, updated System Center tools. So all the new previews of everything needed to deploy 8.1 are out there. You can test that out in a lab, make use of that in the short term. We've also changed our timelines. First, we've synchronized everything, which you've seen. But for the RTM releases that'll be coming later this year, everything will be out at the same time as well. So we don't have to wait 30, 60, 90 days for all the infrastructure pieces you need to be released so that you can do production deployments of 8.1. With 8.1 deployment, if you were in my session yesterday, we talked about two different ways to deploy it. One is by doing an in-place update, which is something we want to encourage anyone running Windows 8 to do. You can do that on your retail devices by going to the Windows Store and installing the update from the store. But for enterprise devices, you'll have to deploy that update using something like a software distribution tool like Configuration Manager. So you can do the in-place upgrade to go from 8 to 8.1. You can also do the more traditional deployments with MDT or Config Manager to go from Windows 7 or earlier operating systems to 8.1. So from a deployment perspective, it's not really changed that much from a technology and features perspective. It's mostly about just the incremental updates for the new versions of the tools. So it should be easy to move forward on each of the pieces required there. From a manageability perspective, the big push this week was around the open MDM capability. So there's now a built-in MDM agent in the operating system that allows manageability through Windows Intune, but now also through third-party management tools. So AirWatch, MobileIron, and others will be able to manage Windows 8.1 devices and Windows RT 8.1 devices. So that'll be interesting to see how that evolves over the next few months. So if you are currently using a non-Microsoft MDM solution, you'll be able to manage your Windows 8.1 machines with that. Let's see, manageability, deployment. What was the other thing I did? Oh, Windows RT. We talked about Windows RT the other day as well, and the big thing that's gotten everyone's interest with Windows RT is Outlook, that there's a version of Outlook included on those devices now. So for those of you who have picked up a Surface RT and had it shipped to your homes, when you get there, please install the 8.1 update and try out the new functionality that's in Windows RT. Outlook would be one of them. Workplace Join, which is a security feature that's also related to manageability as well in Windows RT, you can try that out. And work folders. So we've got some functions with work folders and Workplace Join that tie together the new features in Windows 8.1 and Windows RT 8.1 with what's also provided in Windows Server 2012 R2. So some features that require both of those. Okay.
Ronnie? Okay.
Hi, everybody. So I'm going to talk about MDOP. So since not everybody in the audience knows what MDOP is, I'll just give a brief introduction what that is and then talk about 8.1 as well. So MDOP stands for Microsoft Desktop Optimization Pack. It's a suite of products you can purchase or subscribe to on top of SA. The products are AppVi, UEV, MBAM, AGPM, MedV, and Dart. Okay. So kind of breaking it out into what it does, it's supporting Windows and Windows 8 and Windows 8.1 because it supports the personalization, the virtualization, and the manageability of those desktops running those running the operating system. Breaking it down from an AppVi perspective, AppVi is the product that's the longest there. It's associated with the purchase of Softricity in 2006, but it allows you to virtualize your applications. And that kind of gets rid of the issue where applications, when you deploy them on a machine, they can trip each other up because they're fighting for the same resources. With AppVi, you can stream an application to your desktop, and it runs in a bubble on that desktop, so avoiding this DLL hell, as we call it, on your PC. So it helps from a deployment point of view of applications and avoiding those conflicts that we talk about. So that would be kind of the longest running product there since about 2005, 2006. Then we have a product called UEV, which is User Experience Virtualization. And in terms of the personalization, what that allows you to do, it's the equivalent of what we do with MSA, but except you don't need SkyDrive, you're actually doing it locally in your own data center or on your own system. But essentially what you're able to do is you're able to manage the settings so that your users, as they switch to different PCs or bring your own device, whatever, their settings follow them. So their settings from an application point of view, or even from a Teams point of view, their background, all those kind of settings are configurable through UEV. So it's a very strong product. UEV was released about just 8 months ago, but we've seen strong take-up on it. And the pain point it's addressing is really around when a user logs into one machine and then goes to another machine, on occasion, taking all their settings down and all their profiles, etc., can take a long time. With UEV, you're getting rid of that pain point because it's much more streamlined, much more managed, and they're up and running very quickly. The third product within MDOP is a product called MBAM, and it works with Chris. Yeah. Chris manages this product. But essentially, MBAM is a product, we're at 2.0 right now, where you can manage your BitLocker environment on your PCs. So as you know, BitLocker comes out of the box with 8 and 8.1 and 7, etc., that allows you to encrypt your drive. With MBAM, you can manage that environment. You can generate reports. You can allow, with 2.0, you're allowed to do self-service. So people, if they forget their PIN, which can be a bit of a pain, they can actually recover it themselves. So it's a cool feature. It integrates with CM, as does UEV and AppV, so you have a scalability point of view, so you can support up to thousands and thousands of PCs and manage that whole scenario.
Yeah, we have almost 200 and something thousand under management at Microsoft with MBAM 2.0.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's MBAM. And another product that we have is Dart, which has been around quite a while as well. And that's associated with recovering your PCs as well. So when your PC isn't booting, you can use Dart to get under the hood and address the issue that's breaking the PC. It's about 14 products actually in one, doing different things in terms of the whole recovery of your PC and management of your PC. We have Group Policy Manager, AGPM, which allows you to manage your policies. That's another tool. And then the final one is MedV, which helps address issues where if you've old XP applications, as you know, we should be migrating soon because April 2014 is coming soon. But you have MedV as a product that allows you to, as a stopgap, run that in an XP bubble on your PC to get over that compatibility issue. So it's a suite of 6 products, right? Chances are a lot of you have access to it already because if you have SA, potentially you've already purchased this. We find that a lot of our customers actually use one or two of the products, but we're always trying to encourage them to use more and more. So finally, from the point of view of 8.1, if you're looking at the keynote yesterday, hopefully you noticed, UEV and AppV, there was a slide on that when John was waiting for his PC to boot up the second PC. We have a beta available as of yesterday. It's called UEV 2.0 beta, and then we have AppV 5.0 SP2 beta, and we've also got 4.6 AppV SP3, and they're supporting 8.1. And they have some cool features in there as well in terms of managing Windows 8 apps with UEV, so the settings associated with Windows 8 apps. We also have a company settings center, which allows your users to actually manage their own syncing, so it's a cool feature as well. And we've made some changes under the hood in terms of the sync engine itself. And then finally, with AppV, we have improved the look and feel of how the application performs in allowing people to have a right-click functionality, so they can get WinZip, etc. So the application that's streamed with AppV behaves exactly like with an application that's installed in your machine. So that's pretty much it.
Excellent. So just a friendly reminder, about 5 more minutes, we got a few more updates here. Be thinking questions that you have, anything right that you were afraid to ask. We'll try to keep it light, not vicious type of questions, so we can keep it friendly. So I'll just wrap up, and then I'll walk around with the mic, and we'll take some questions. So just starting on the networking side, in Windows 8 and when Server 2012 came out, it really improved direct access. And we talked a lot about that through the launch early October last year and on about the improvements, making it simpler, removing the UAG requirement for direct access as well. We also know that enterprises and customers need more than just a domain-joined capability to access services remotely when we're on the road securely. We mentioned yesterday and have been talking a little bit about some of the new VPN capabilities that are coming into 8.1 across both ARM platforms and Intel platforms, so x86. One of those is inbox VPN clients. So there are 5 partners that we've worked with today that will come with inbox VPNs. Those are F5, Checkpoint, Juniper, Dell, and SonicWall. We expect more of those. What we mean by inbox is that it is in the box when it's shipped in the client. So from an ARM perspective, if you have one of those backends to access, the client's already in there. If you remember it previously, you can't load that type of an application on an ARM platform PC. So that was a nice improvement. Along with that, similar to the way that direct access works, the inbox clients can auto-trigger. And we highlighted that in the keynote yesterday as well. What we mean by auto trigger is if I'm on the internet and I'm in my webmail and I need to access a SharePoint site that I have to have a VPN client for, if you think the way that VPNs work now, when you click on that, if the VPN's not running, you get a message that says can't access the network. The way that auto trigger VPN works is that in place of receiving that negative message, it'll be a positive message. A notification will come up, you'll click on it, and you'll put your credentials in. You can also set it up to be truly auto-triggered. And what that means is if you allow your Windows credentials to be the VPN credentials, when I click that SharePoint site, what will happen is the VPN will trigger in the background, and I will be able to access that. So that's a very direct access-like capability with the Inbox VPN clients, so the new ones as well as the Microsoft ones. And that can be across anything. That doesn't require the domain join capabilities that Direct Access did. Just a couple other connectivity things we highlighted in the keynote yesterday. Integrating some first-class experiences for near-field communication in with 8.1 as well. Some things like tap-to-pair printing is a capability that is going to be in Box. And John showed that during the keynote yesterday. Miracast wireless display capabilities in Box in the clients now. A much more integrated experience. Down the road, we would expect a pairing mechanism to also be NFC related. So I walk into my conference room, and instead of having to put a, have a dongle, have a different thing to connect to the projector, I could tap my PC, the NFC piece, and pair to Miracast and start projecting there as well. So those are some of the highlights of the general networking pieces. Last thing on Windows to Go, not a ton of new stuff there. If you've used Windows to Go or deployed it or looked at it in Windows 8, there was one big area where a Windows to Go deployment really differed from Windows 8, and that was we had the Windows Store turned off by default. The ramifications of that were I couldn't access the Windows Store on my Windows to Go drive, I couldn't pull down apps from the Windows Store, and probably even more that we heard concerns about was I couldn't update the Inbox apps. So the mail app or the weather app, if there was an update, we couldn't update it if we couldn't access the Windows Store. With 8.1, it's turned on by default. So we've corrected that the Windows Store recognizes Windows to Go as a drive, and we can roam around, have the Windows Store on. So that's really the major improvement from a Windows to Go perspective that we updated. We continue to work with new drive vendors and to make sure that all the existing drives will boot across a wide variety of machines as well. So with that, we're about 23 minutes in. So we'd like to kind of switch gears here and make this a little more interactive and take questions across any of these areas. Any other things that you saw in the keynote yesterday as well? I know there were some UI pieces. Assigned access was something that was demoed. So any of the areas that you have some questions about, deep deployment questions, Michael is absolutely happy to answer something about that as well. So if you have a question, feel free to just start raising your hands, and I'll roam around with the mic so that we can hear the question across the room, and then we'll maybe be able to answer those for you. So we always have a first one. So
good night.
Thank you.
This is a security question. So the virtual smart cards look really interesting. I assume that you have to put a password in or a PIN in order if you are using a virtual smart card. You also have to do the same thing with BitLocker. So if you were using a virtual smart card and BitLocker, would you have to put in kind of two PINs? What would be the user experience?
Okay. Yeah, so that's a good question. So in the case of virtual smart cards, they are identical in the way you interact with them and even in some respects the way you provision them, although there's not a physical element to it. As a physical smart card. So that means you're going to have a certificate. In this case, it's going to be bound to the TPM of your device rather than a chip on a card. And you will have a PIN as well. So you'll still have that experience. And then the second part of the question is, well, what about BitLocker when I boot? If I have pre-boot authentication enabled, do I have a PIN or a password there? And the answer is yes. So and those don't necessarily have to be the same. So if you had a situation where you wanted to have pre-boot authentication with PIN and you also wanted to require sign-in with the virtual smart cards into Windows, you would have an experience of having to enter it in twice. And they could be different or they could be the same, actually. So there's still, I think, some work to do to make that perfect. Some of that work has actually already happened in 8. So for those of you who are familiar, who's using an encryption technology and requires pre-boot to boot their PCs? Maybe just a quick raise of hands. Okay. So a lot of you, maybe half of you, probably more. So the reason why you have pre-boot authentication, many people have forgotten why, and because they've just accepted, oh yeah, you need pre-boot, we can't have PCs booting, and we need to shut them down completely. And so that was used to be true because we used to have a lot of cold boot attack vectors that were possible on the devices. Well, as we moved into Windows 8, our goal was to start the journey or the process of getting rid of cold boot attack vectors from the platform. And so in the case of our tablets, for instance, we have a new certification. It's called Instant Go. We called it Connected Standby last year. We renamed it this year, of course, because that's what we like to do sometimes. But anyway, what this requirements, the requirements for Instant Go have are no DMA ports. Is the important thing. And so that eliminates the cold boot attack vector where somebody would insert a device into your FireWire port, dump your system memory, steal your encryption keys, and then decrypt your drive. So on these tablets that you're using, like Windows RT is an example, and pretty much all the tablets, they don't have these ports. And in our view, is DMA ports are a really bad thing. You might like him back in the old days because it gave you direct memory access. He was a developer back in the day, so he would have those use cases. But in your corporate environment, for non-development purposes, there's really not a lot of need for DMA access, although the ports themselves, like FireWire, were useful in their time. But anyway, we've moved away from FireWire. I don't even know if there are any new devices shipping with FireWire. Connected standby devices can't have these ports, and so we don't really need pre-boot on those tablets. Now, with Haswell processor line, which just shipped, I think, on June 4th, you're actually seeing this Instant Go technology move from tablets into laptops, into all-in-ones, and maybe even desktops. We'll see what the OEMs do with Haswell. But what this means is we're going to have a condition where we don't even need pre-boot authentication maybe on our laptops, right? Depends what the OEMs do, but that's what we're trying to get the device manufacturers to deliver. So the story is we're moving away from pre-boot because we're trying to create the condition where the devices out there don't need it. Because pre-boot just gets in your way. And, you know, I see a couple iPads and some other tablet devices up front here, right? The experience with your mobile phone and those, which is so great, is when you turn the power button on, it's always on, right? It doesn't have to boot. You don't have to go through some pre-boot authentication, et cetera. And so that's what we're trying to do with Windows all up. And we've achieved it with the connected standby devices, but we have some work to push it down into others. So we hope soon you won't need pre-boot and that your startup experience will be using your smart card in your organization to sign in to your device, and it will be one authentication. Does that? Oh, okay, good.
Right, I think I saw you. Right up here.
So kind of a deployment question. On your Windows RT, if you upgrade to 8.1 preview, and this is a boot device, how do you then upgrade to RTM again when 8.1 is released?
So you have a couple of choices. When you update your Windows RT device from the original version to the 8.1 preview, that won't touch the existing recovery partition on the device. So if you go in then and do the reset my PC, it would reset you back to the original Windows 8 version of Windows RT. So that would be one option. Roll the machine back to the original Windows RT and then update it to the final 8.1 release. The other option that you would be able to do is go directly from the preview to the RTM version. In order to do that, there'll be some manual steps involved. The store won't offer you that directly. You would have to go to the preview site, click a link. It would take you to the store and show you the RTM version of RT, or you could click an install. It will migrate your user data and your accounts, but it won't migrate your apps. So you would have to then go into the Windows Store, go to the My Apps page, select all the applications that you had previously installed, and click the install button to bring those back down. So either of those routes work. Either of those routes requires reinstalling your applications, but at least on Windows RT, that's a fairly trivial process since you can go to the store and just say, here's the list of apps that I had before, please install them on this device.
connectivity question. How about third-party VPN support for Windows RT, like Juniper, F5?
Okay, sure. And I know we have people coming in. So in Windows RT, as well as on the x86, 8.1, across both of these platforms, we'll have, right now, there are five vendors that have inbox support. So there's a Junos client, there's an F5 client, there's a Dell client, a SonicWall client, and a Checkpoint client that's inbox with that now, which will connect back to your existing infrastructure. Those are manageable, the profiles, the deployment of that is manageable through what Michael mentioned about the open management platform, the APIs that are exposed through Intune or through some of the other third-party platforms as well to make it more manageable from a business perspective. If you look in the release preview as it comes out of this, I believe three made it into the preview build. And I can't remember which three are in the preview build right now, but if you go into your PC settings and VPN, you can click down and see the three that are in there now. And then at RTM, the other two, and maybe more, will make it in at that point.
I have a two-part question. First part is AppV for RT and ARM devices. Is that something that is potentially going to come as more users are going to be buying their own devices, the whole BYOD field?
Well, it's something we're looking at all the different features coming down the road. It's something we're looking at, but I don't have any guarantees.
Yeah, but when you're talking about Windows RT, what would you...
How would you virtualize it in
yeah,
that case?
You can't virtualize an x86 application and expect it to run on an ARM device. That one's just not possible. Plus, the device doesn't have the horsepower to run any type of virtualization technology to, say, run a virtual machine of x86 on an ARM device. So you won't see any type of desktop apps ever being virtualized and run on an ARM device. So that part of it,
no.
That definitely not going to happen. For some of the other pieces, yeah, maybe there's some potential. Yeah.
And my second part of the question was more, what are the minimum domain requirements for all these new features? Because with our company, and I'm assuming others as well, you always end up with one application or server somewhere that stops you from increasing your domain level.
When you look at Windows 8.1 overall, there's no requirement for any Active Directory schema updates. But there are some new Windows 8.1 features that are tied to the Windows Server 2012 R2 functionality that's been added in the preview for that. So if you're using one of those capabilities, then you would need to do a schema update and be using those features with at least one Server 2012 R2 server. The ones that I'm aware of at this point are work folders, which is a Server 2012 R2 feature that requires some schema changes, and workplace join creates some new objects in order to store the trusted device information in Active Directory. Outside of that, I'm not aware of any other features that require the schema updates. But there's definitely no requirement for new Active Directory domain controllers, just schema updates and potentially some Server 2012 R2 servers in order to support the new features.
So a quick security question. Is there any plans to sort out the attack vector for Windows 7 and BitLocker where you read the direct memory? Even with pre-boot, you can still access the memory and decrypt the drives and get through all that. Is there any plans to in a service pack or something like that, fix the issues or somehow block the attack vector?
No, I didn't get the question clearly. I'm sorry.
Do you hear me now? Can you hear this?
Yeah, it was a little muffled. It was kind of...
In BitLocker now, you can read the memory. Even with pre-boot, you can use a FireWire and read the memory. So if you have a laptop that's, say, 2 years old, you still have a FireWire port.
Sure.
Is there plans to in the service pack for Windows 7 or Windows 8 to sort that out somehow to block the way to do that?
Yeah, our strategy, as I mentioned, is to move away from pre-boot, but to deal with the reality of the devices you have for maybe the next 5 years or longer. In the case of FireWire, our recommendation is, since customers are not using that regularly, I haven't actually met one. I know that somebody's got a device that requires FireWire, but if we look at the numbers are really low. Our recommendation would be to mitigate that attack vector by disabling the FireWire port. So in other words, we're not making a lot of investments to make pre-boot better. Our investments are to make pre-boot non-required by through improved devices. So our recommendation would be to disable the FireWire port that's probably not being used. The other thing that's related to pre-boot is there's another cold boot attack that's a little harder to pull off, which is freezing the memory and then extracting the memory and putting it in a device. And maybe you can get an accurate dump and maybe you can find the key. That is technically possible, but it's really more of a hypothetical. There's a video on YouTube where you can see where they're able to successfully do it. The thing that's not clear in that video is that attack vector only really works on a certain memory, on certain devices. It's not reliable. Even if you had identical memory and an identical device, the same manufacturer, it may not work on an identical thing. So it is possible. You need to be worried about it, especially if you're a Department of Defense and these types of people, right? Because you have zero tolerance for this type of attack vector. But if you think that frozen memory trick is something that can be pulled off at its scale with all your devices, that's just simply not true. And there is actually a great report that came from the Department of Defense in Canada. They lined up a bunch of devices and they tried the frozen memory trick on all of them. They found out that it was so unreliable that they decided not to use pre-boot. They're like, we're not worried. And they were Department of Defense. Now, I think that they should be worried about it because I think they're a target. But I think that should give you, if you're worried about that attack vector, at least ask the question, you know, is it really possible on my device? It probably isn't across most of them. Did that help? Yeah.
Small follow-up. Well, the FireWire is going away. Mm-hmm. PCMI, the smart card, those are not. And you can still buy cards that enable FireWire, and you still load for pre-boot, and still work on laptops.
Yeah, there's some challenges there.
Chris, would you mind just repeating that since we didn't have that microphone over
there?
Sure.
The net of the question is there may be new technologies or maybe even some existing technologies that might have DMA access, and that is true. And so we're working with Intel. We're trying to get to a place where things like Thunderbolt in the future will not have unauthenticated port access. So that's going to take some time, and that's challenging, right? I mean, they don't have the same priorities we do, so we have to work with them. What I would say is this, is, you know, when we look at the competition, when we're looking at BitLocker, our competition does have a richer set of pre-boot authentication options. So if we look at McAfee and Symantec, they have single sign-on from pre-boot, right? That's a pretty cool feature. And so a lot of customers have thought, well, if I need that type of behavior, then I have to make a decision between BitLocker and McAfee. And that's not really true anymore, because what you're seeing in the marketplace is third parties, Sophos, Dell, Credent, and Wave Systems, and there will be others following, are now deciding that, hey, managing BitLocker is better for their business than completely competing with it. So Sophos, for instance, can make BitLocker better, and I'm sorry to say this, Ronnie, than InBAM in some respects, because it has a richer set of management options. So you don't have to think, oh, do I use BitLocker or do I use third party? You may use BitLocker plus three third party. So if you need a richer pre-boot authentication option, you can look towards a third party to maybe accommodate that. So that's a good workaround. We find that in most cases, BitLocker has the richness that customers expect. But in the cases where it's not, you know, think about using BitLocker plus third party. And we expect that maybe Symantec, maybe McAfee's, that maybe they'll do the same thing that these other companies will do. And this might be even likely because we now have device encryption in all editions of Windows. So BitLocker, in some respects, is in all editions, whereas before it was only Pro and Enterprise. So I think this will become more attractive. And then one last thing is when we look at our encryption engine versus any of the other third parties, the reliability and the performance of it, in our view, is superior. And so it's actually a really great deal to use BitLocker with a third party, because then maybe you get the best of both worlds, maybe the extra management plus the reliability of BitLocker. So anyway, that's kind of our strategy.
Perfect. Thank you. Oh, question up here. Yep, go ahead. Try. Give it a shot there.
Hello. Now you have a new version on 8.1. It's build 6.3. It's a new kernel. Will we see any problems with device drivers here now?
We don't expect there to be any significant challenges with device drivers. There will always be the exceptions to the rule, but From what we've seen so far, most of the Windows 7 and Windows 8 drivers will work fine. There is one notable exception that we did put in the FAQ around DisplayPort drivers. There are new DisplayPort drivers available through DisplayPort.com that are required to support any type of USB port replicator using DisplayPort with the Windows 8.1 preview. But so far, we haven't seen any other challenges with drivers, so it should be okay.
And the second question is about WinPE. Will it be possible to do Wi-Fi deployment with WinPE?
Not yet. It's something that we've asked for multiple times, but still Windows PE doesn't include Wi-Fi support. So you'll have to do wired networking or USB deployments for devices that don't have wired network or don't have wired ports.
And it will be many of those devices now, like your own Surface and everything.
Right.
Any time frame?
For doing what?
WinPE with Wi-Fi.
Oh, WinPE for Wi-Fi. Well, it's not in 8.1, so we'll have the discussion again as they begin the planning process for the next version of Windows, but no promises.
Just a quick follow-up on the FireWire attack vector. I've been told there is a KB article describing a hotfix which actually disables FireWire, and that's one way to get around the fact that you can put in a slotting card which have a FireWire hardware even though your PC doesn't have it. Is that correct?
I'm not familiar with that particular KB article. There is a blog actually that talks about the approach to mitigating cold boot attacks, and it's fairly detailed. It talks specifically about FireWire, and that article is pretty old actually. It's about 3 years old, and it was written in response to a company called Passware that said that BitLocker can be hacked, and so they were correct that it can be hacked if you configure it with worst practices. So if you configure it correctly and don't shoot yourself in the head, you're going to be okay. If you do it incorrectly, then the password tool can steal your keys. So there is an article. There may be a KB that helps support it with additional information. Yeah.
All right. Anybody in the back here, portion of the room with questions? Nothing UI related. We usually get a couple UI related questions.
Don't invite that.
The new stuff that was shown, that Brad McCabe shown, the new stuff coming through, the ability to set through GP group policy, some of the start screen and share that. Go back over here.
Hi, I have a question about MDAP and Dart. There's the remote connection, and when our users are, away of the office, how does it, affect on the user? Does it always require some kind of boot from a USB drive, or can you start it from just an app?
So the question's around Dart?
Dart? Yeah. Dart.
Yes.
On the user side.
Right. So it's the remote connect capabilities on Dart. So that goes kind of into deployment models when you're thinking about that. So the remote machine does need to boot into Dart, right? So you have to boot into that environment. You could have it already installed in that recovery partition locally, and you can do that through the deployment process. You could have it on recovery media, such as a USB or a CD, something like that. If they had a network capability, a Pixie boot, is a way to do that as well. So you have methods, but the remote machine does have to boot into Dart to be accessible from the IT person's location.
Yeah, so the Dart remote viewer is entirely in Windows PE, so the challenge is going to be if you have a device that's not directly network accessible. So if you have a device that's out on the internet, the odds of you being able to directly talk to that device to get to the Dart agent, even if they booted into Windows RT, is fairly small. So you're going to be better off with remote assistance in most cases to make a remote assistance connection when it's in the full OS, assuming the full OS is completely functional.
Back up front here.
Right, Michael, Windows RT, factory reset. this update is not applicable to your computer, Windows 8.1. Any ideas?
Yes. One of the challenges with the preview release for Windows 8.1 is we've only released some languages. And the languages are listed somewhere, but basically the only English one is ENUS. So if you have a Surface device that's deployed or was purchased in the US and came pre-installed as an ENUS system, no problem. But if you have a ENGB system or EN Australia or any other English locale, the update won't install, and even if you could work around that, the store doesn't have the images available to offer to you. There are some articles floating around about workarounds to try to hack that to work, but it's not supported at this point. It's preferable to wait for the other languages to become available. I don't remember the exact list of languages that are out there, but there's like 15 total languages available, and the only English one at the moment is US.
It's a fairly simple question about the biometric sensors that I saw yesterday that are being demonstrated in some of the sessions. Are they, at the moment it looks like it's a standalone sensor, but are the manufacturers, the PC manufacturers, taking them on and going to be integrating them into their units?
So questions like when are they going to show up in the marketplace? And so this year, it's possible we'll see the touch sensors. The swipe sensors are already in market, or you had those forever. And those have liveness detection. They're good from a security perspective, but they're not very good from a usability perspective. So the touch sensors, hopefully we'll see some makes and models this year. The companies like Fingerprint Cards and Validity and Edgestack, and these, they're working very hard with OEMs, of course, to try to get these to market. But we don't have any commitments yet. So I'm hoping later in the year we'll have clarity on what will happen this year, if anything. But we know that next year we'll start to see devices with this technology. So worst case scenario, next year, but I'm hoping we'll see at least a few models out there. And they'll probably start in maybe the higher end commercial, because they need to, these devices have been over $100, sometimes $200 for each sensor, and so they really need to ramp it at scale. So I think you'll see them in more premium devices if they are to appear this year.
I have a simple UI question. A lot of us use the Windows X key or right-click on the 8.1 now, but the text that it pops up isn't exactly very pretty. Is there any plans to make that menu option look better?
Sadly, our UI guy's in London. Did you have some information?
Most people are just happy that it's there.
Yeah, absolutely, very happy that it's there. But
the fact that it's not the prettiest menu in the world isn't a high concern at this point. Thought you were going to ask something harder about it. But yeah, I don't think that we'll make it any prettier. The feedback has been fairly positive so far with the changes that we've made to that. If you haven't yet looked at the Windows X menu, they've added new options for shutdown, restart. The default options have changed from command prompt admin to PowerShell, PowerShell admin. For those of you who refuse to give up on command prompts, there is a setting in the Explorer properties where you can change those back to command prompt and command prompt admin, but we're hoping that people will switch over to PowerShell much more heavily.
Well, two questions regarding deployment. The first question is that for MDT 2010 deployment shares, could it be possible to easily adapt it to the MDT 2012 and the new version without making any change or doing kind of an upgrade of the deployment resources?
So the question is, can you upgrade an MDT 2010 deployment share?
Mm-hmm.
You can certainly do that. If you go from MDT 2010 or MDT 2012 update 1, you can install MDT 2013 on the machine and then use that to upgrade your existing deployment share. your existing task sequences would continue to be fine. You just wouldn't pick up the new features from MDT 2012 and 2013 if you were to upgrade your existing 2010 deployment share. But we do test older task sequences to make sure that they still work with the new versions of all the scripts and tools that we add in. So that should work okay. Still, test it out first in your lab. What we would generally encourage you to do, especially with the preview release, is take your existing deployment share, X-copy it to another location on another machine, install MDT 2013 on that other machine, upgrade the copy, try it out, and assuming everything works okay, you can then go back later and upgrade your production deployment share.
And the second question is regarding, you mentioned before deployment using USB drives, right? And for some devices, like for example the Surface, where they only allow booting from a 32 booting devices. Sometimes this could be a problem if your deployment image is larger than a 2GX file. So,
yeah, the challenge that you're talking about generally comes into play when we start to deal with the UEFI devices. UEFI has a requirement that the boot files are on a FAT32 partition. And most USB keys report themselves as removable devices, and as a result, you can't partition them. You can only create a single partition on them, and you would then have to format that as FAT32 in order to get a UEFI system to boot it. So FAT32 has a file size limitation. It only allows for up to a 4 GB file. So if your WIM file, if your Windows image is larger than 4 GB, you can't put it on a FAT32 media. So what you have to do is you have to be a little more creative and try to use one of the workarounds. What we've talked about from a workaround perspective is a few different options. One is switch away from USB keys to USB hard drives, because USB hard drives don't have that limitation. You can partition them with a FAT32 boot partition and then a large NTFS partition for everything else. That's the easiest if you don't mind carrying around the larger USB hard drive. The second option would be use two different USB keys, especially if the device has multiple USB ports. You can put the boot files on one and all your deployment files on the other. As soon as you've booted from the USB key, the FAT32 one, you don't need it anymore. The rest of the deployment can use the NTFS key. The third option is use a Windows to Go stick. Windows to Go, the drives report themselves as fixed drives, and as a result, they can be partitioned. So you can partition them with two partitions, a FAT32 boot partition and an NTFS data partition, and now you're back down to the small size of a USB key, plus you get the performance of the Windows to Go sticks, which are great from a deployment perspective. You just use one of those for deployment rather than for running Windows to Go.
Other questions? Any other highlights we think we could share across anything that we haven't talked about? Questions we got in the sessions that came up?
So just in terms of the announcement yesterday, there's more detail on that beta on the Windows Springboard blog. I'd encourage you to look at that as well. Common questions we got actually over at the booth and in some of the, we did a focus group as well, was around the roadmap for MDOP. And rest assured, with the basis coming out, we have Windows and MDOP are joined at the hip. There's a lot of investment in MDOP, an ongoing investment. We see the whole area around security, application virtualization, and the new product user state, the UEV virtualization, is joining that with that feed. Is a very, very powerful solution. And it was a part, in terms of John Devan's demo yesterday, there are powerful solutions that go hand in hand with the mobility scenario and bring your own device scenario with Windows and Windows 8.1. So I would encourage you to look at Springboard at the blog we have there and to test out the latest versions, 5.0, for example, on AppFi. So that was some of the questions we got in the focus group, was around the roadmap. We're rest assured we have a regular cadence and there's a lot of investment in MDOP.
So just a general question. How many of you regularly read the Springboard blog? Not too many. So we should probably talk about where that is. If you go to blogs.windows.com, there is a list of a variety of blogs that are out there. Most of the official Windows blogs are through that site. Springboard is one of those. Springboard is an IT pro-focused blog where it has more technical information targeting IT pros on various Windows topics. So we did a few postings yesterday. One was for the new M.dot beta. We did a second one for the release of the ISO files for the 8.1 preview, talking about different deployment scenarios. So with Windows 8.1 and a retail device, you can update from the store. With 8.1 and the ISOs, you can update your volume license Windows 8 Pro machines. In the future, we'll be making available Windows 8.1 Enterprise preview. What happens when you want to go to RTM? So we tried to provide that technical detail through the Springboard blog. So you'll continue to see more information on 8.1, the technical information being released through that blog. There's also a Windows for Your Business blog that's kind of the higher level business focus discussions on that same site, which is also generally from people in our group. The Springboard site itself is actually hosted on TechNet. How many of you have seen the Springboard TechNet site? Wow. We've got work to do.
We certainly do. Yeah.
So Springboard is basically the site where we've tried to consolidate all of the information about Windows in the enterprise. So what do you need to know about Windows to effectively use it in the enterprise? We did post a very good article that says what's new in Windows 8.1, which goes through all the major features and gives you a paragraph level description of each one of those. That's great to read through, but there's a whole set of documentation that talks about how do you plan for a new version of Windows? How do you build your images? How do you deploy your images? How do you maintain the environment? How do you manage the environment? So it's a very extensive set of information out on the TechNet site.
Very good.
One other quick thing. In terms of UEV itself, I'd mentioned that it was launched 8 months ago. And the version we have now is the 2.0 beta. When we ran the focus groups and when we ran it at TechEd North America, honestly, there wasn't a lot of awareness about the product. But once we ran some sessions actually yesterday on UEV, for example, a guy called Tim Crabb ran a session. But once we described the product, the real message is it's so simple to deploy. It involves like a common share and deploying an agent, very non-invasive to your environment. So I've had customers come up to me afterwards and say, I'm going to try it next week, and they can. So if you own MDOP or if you think you own MDOP, but you also have the beta now anyway, you can test it out. And the value, you can get early quick wins in terms of personalization and managing your environment, managing your settings, and simplifying and keeping your users happy. So the deployment thing was a message that I really received and gave back in terms of UEV. Okay.
Yeah, just a general question around those lines. How many of you use roaming profiles? Those would be good to look at UEV as a replacement for that, especially in the multiple device, multiple operating system scenarios. Having roaming profiles when you're using multiple devices is not always the best experience. And if you have, say, a Windows 7 desktop and you then get a Windows 8 or 8.1 tablet, the roaming profile issues that you could run into between those can be challenging. But using UEV combined with redirected folders, offline folders are now the new work folders with Server 2012 R2, can alleviate all of those challenges. So UEV is very nice for that.
UEV question. If you run the UEV agent on an RDS server, will it pick up every user or just the first one that loads in? Because VDI and RDS kind of differs a lot.
So that question came up yesterday as well. I think it depends on how you manage the security and the sharing on that file. So the file system that you set up for the UEV users, it should be locked down, so each user only access their own settings. So the profile of the user, it the same applies where you run it. So they shouldn't trip each other up.
Yeah, those tend to be the demos that we show for UEV as well. Mm. You make a setting change on your Windows laptop, and then log into an RDS session and you see the same change is already applied. Then you go into a VDI session and you see the same setting has been applied. So whatever device you touch, it's pulling from those same standard setting store.
How many people went to or saw the Windows keynote, which was yesterday morning? It's got a pretty good portion. Any bets on if the RT is going to make it out of the water that it dumped in? We have it sitting back. We ordered a bunch of rice, dry rice, and we're trying to dry that out to see if it will come back to life down the road. So we've been taking some bets on it to see if it will. I think it will, but I don't know.
Yeah, we'll blog about it. If it survives, there'll be a video.
We won't cheat.
There's I think there's about 60 screws in that, so it's gonna be a challenge to dry that thing out. It's a pretty dense little device, but we'll see.
Any other questions?
Hi. With Windows 7, we had a functionality to check the battery status and if the battery of a mobile device was decreasing, I think, down to 40% of the original capacity. The operating system told me that this battery is going to die and I should replace it. Is this the same in Windows 8 or 8.1? Do we have that functionality still? Which is a crap, by the way. But
my understanding is that that's still there and it still does check the overall capacity of the battery, and it will tell you when the available capacity and the rated capacity are drastically different, which is basically what that warning is telling you. If your 5,000 milliamp battery can never be charged above 2,000, well, that's bad. Your battery is not going to be nearly as good as when you started, so it will notify you about that. Those are the messages that you got in XP. I've never actually seen those messages on my devices, which probably means I replace my laptops way too frequently. But if you were to keep an existing battery for years at a time, yeah, Windows should continue to tell you that your battery is degraded.
Right now, we have a lot of devices where you cannot change the battery. So what's happened there? With my RT, for example, will it tell me, please get rid of the device, buy a new one, or
get a fish tank.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that is a challenge with the devices. They've made a lot of progress with batteries over the years to make sure that they don't degrade as quickly. But over time, all batteries do degrade. So a two-year-old device is not going to have the same battery life as a brand new device. That's a given. But we've kind of gotten to the age of disposable devices, so people are just used to that idea that after 2 years, yeah, I'm just going to get a new one. Most of the people in the room here are probably replacing them more frequently than that. But so you don't really care that it has a battery sealed inside of it.
So I myself for sure, but our users, so I'm working for a company where we did a Windows 7 rollout just recently, and we had now hundreds of users coming up, never claimed anything about the battery, but now receiving this message, your battery is old, please replace it. These are Dell laptops, 1.5 years old or 2 years old. They are still, I don't know the English word there. The funding is not over or whatever. It's about
warranty.
3 years.
Warranty, yeah, warranty. Yeah,
warranty. Yeah, yeah. So these are thousands of bucks just for replacing batteries, and the user experience is really bad. They didn't even know that the battery is decreasing because they're working with the docking stations all the time. But now they're coming to our desk and say, my battery is broken. I need a new one. I was told. I was warned. So help me.
Michael, do you know, is there any way, best practice certainly would be not to turn something like that off, but is there a way to turn off that battery warning?
Yeah, someone had asked that last night at the Ask the Experts, and we were trying to find an answer and didn't find an answer. There is a checkbox on the warning that says never show this warning again, which presumably stores a registry setting that says never show this again, but no one's been able to locate that registry setting yet. So if that's a concern, send me an email. We'll continue to try to find out where that particular setting gets stored.
those offer things.
It's a good solution.
Yeah. And just one more note on that. I think the nice thing is that you mentioned the Surface with the battery. It's included. You can't replace those types of things. One of the nice things, at least I find about the Windows ecosystem, is that certainly we would, you know, I mean, it'd be great as Microsoft to have you buy a Surface. But there's a great ecosystem of devices out there. There's some nice tablet sizes that do come with replaceable batteries. So then you'll be getting those warnings, right? But you could replace the battery in it, and that tablet might live a longer lifetime. Dell has one. It's an XPS 10, if I can remember the name of it, that does have a replaceable battery on it, too. So there are a few out there that do, that you can replace that battery on.
Yeah. But that also comes up with SSDs. There are companies out there, the particularly paranoid ones, that will want to remove the hard drive before they get rid of an old device. And if you have a sealed device and you can't get to the hard drive, well, what are you going to do? You're going to shred the whole device? Now, they don't want to do that either because there's some value left in the device. They just like to pull the drive. So same thing. They'll just choose devices that have removable hard drives rather than something like a Surface where it's embedded in the device. Remove 37 screws and, okay, maybe you can pull it out. But most people aren't going to bother. So there are definitely choices out there.
All right, Dan, about 10 minutes left. We're certainly happy to stay the whole time if we have some questions. If not, we'll be around up here as well. So just in wrap up, I think any, oh, Jim, did you have a question? Sure, hey, absolutely, stop me.
the MBAM, was it MBAM named? I have seen that session, it's very interesting, and I was wondering now if my device is not working anymore and I'm starting the Dart environment, is it also possible to connect to the MBAM and have a self-service to receive my my BitLocker key?
From Dart itself?
Yeah.
I'm not real familiar with that experience in Dart.
Yeah. So. I don't think so. One is after the other. So.
Yeah, generally you would access the Dart page from a browser to get the recovery key, and then one screen sitting there with the key, and then you could interact with the laptop via Dart to type it in if you wanted to, but most of the time you'd just be retyping the 48-character key. Yeah,
you still.
But that's a cool idea.
Yeah.
So we will take that as feedback. That's something I think would be pretty interesting.
Yeah. So last thing, I guess if we just have a couple minutes left, favorite feature, maybe not related to what each of us talks about. Do you want to start, Ronnie, in 8.1?
Let me think of you. You stumped me there for
a second.
Do you
want to come back to you?
Yeah, too, yeah.
Michael, do you want to start?
Yeah.
Gosh.
Chris?
Favorite feature in 8.1.
I'll go. Okay. Because
I'll go.
I mean, biometrics has to be one of the coolest things because
that's in your feature
that's
area.
That's in my feature area, so I'm selfish like that. But I mean, the thing that's so great about biometrics is we do need to move away from passwords, right? We all know how bad it is. Who's here heard of the Matt Honan article, Kill the Password? Okay, it probably more of a U.S. article probably, but basically what Matt showed that your passwords are clearly not safe, that maybe they can't be guessed, but people can be tricked into giving them away. And they can be stolen. I mean, there's all sorts of things. And so he proved pretty clearly that you don't want to be using passwords. And so we're working hard on getting rid of it. And so biometrics is a great way of starting to move away. It doesn't get rid of them completely, but it's the first step. And it's interesting in that biometrics gives you the ability to improve your user experience by, in my view, a magnitude of order. And increase my security at the same time. That almost never happens. You very rarely improve the user experience with a security feature, but it happened with this. I mean, just imagine if you never had to type a password again. I mean, I know, I bet you I type my password incorrectly 10 times a week, 15 times a week, right? With this, it will never happen. It's touch, and I'm in instantly, and so I love it.
Yeah, it's a great demo. If you saw the keynote demo, it's so simple.
Yeah.
I suppose for me, it's a boot to desktop. So the best of both worlds, that we have the flexibility that if you want to, especially in a commercial environment, you can boot to desktop.
Yeah,
I think that's really cool.
I guess I've been kind of in that multiple machine model for long enough that for me it's SkyDrive, SkyDrive Pro, and now WorkFolders, just to be able to have all of my data on all of my machines. Everything is always synchronized. I had, right before TechEd US, my primary laptop, which I've been a developer in the past. I used the traditional huge developer-style laptop, and my SSD drive died. Completely dead. I can boot it into Windows PE. It says that it's 8 megabytes and it has no data on it. It's dead. So take it into Microsoft IT, have them repair it. Grab another laptop, open it up, log in. All my data's there. I just go. So we have our personal data on SkyDrive. Just by our Microsoft IT guidelines, they tell us put your personal data on SkyDrive. You can put your company data in SkyDrive Pro, and you can also have access to file shares through work folders. So got all those set up. As soon as I log in, everything's there.
Excellent. And I'll be short and brief, and we'll wrap here. I like the hero search. If you saw in the keynote yesterday, this was where Marilyn Monroe was splashed across the screen. When you search for it, it pulled the search up across so many different areas, not just on the PC itself, and gave you that curated app experience almost when you did a search utilizing Bing. I think that's really cool. I love the search in Windows 8 when we went in there and found those things, but that capability, I think, is really cool to be able to find something in that type of an experience. So we'll take one more question, then we will go ahead and wrap up here for you guys.
I'm glad you mentioned that search. Can you disable that so you only search your PC? You don't want to put all your search on Bing so you can use all the data for whatever I don't like you to do.
Yeah, so I don't know if you can disable. Michael, I don't know if you know. What we showed in there was when you searched it, right, you could search across everything. You can still search across those separate things as well. They pop up on the search tab that comes out. So you could limit the search as you're going when you pull that out and look down there and say, I want this in my file settings or those types of things. I do not know if that overall capability can be turned off, though.
Yeah, generally we provided policies for those types of things. I just haven't seen one for that, but I haven't yet gone through all the policies in 8.1. Right. There's a lengthy new list.
Yeah, and I don't know if that length is published yet. It typically goes up on the TechNet page, the 8 to 8.1, and you'll be able to see those differences there. So very good. Well, we certainly thank you for coming as well as participating and asking questions. So hope you have a great rest of your tech ed here and safe travels home when you leave. Thank you.
Thank you.